from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. 1 week ago today, the Federal Appeals Court struck down the Federal Communication Commission's net neutrality rules. The implications of that move are still sinking in. The FCC's net neutrality policy said big carriers like Verizon and Comcast could not prioritize some content providers over others. Now they can. That change over time could change your experience of the internet dramatically, make it far less free range and much more like cable TV, fenced and tiered and pay to play. This hour on Point, what the internet will now be and the fate of net neutrality. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. What do you see coming now for internet users, for internet innovators? What will the web be without net neutrality? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at OnPoint Radio. Joining me first today from Washington is Brian Fung, technology policy reporter for The Washington Post. Brian, thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
So this is all still sinking into people around the country. Why do people care so much about net neutrality, Brian?
Well, one reason is that the internet is obviously a major platform for innovation, and what happens to internet policy could potentially determine a lot of how the internet develops and what services we get down the road.
For years now, people have been drawing up diagrams of what our sort of internet pay-to-play interface might look like if net neutrality went away. Now it's gone away. Does that put us on a path where the big providers, carriers, treat the internet like we treat cable television now? We get a menu of what we want to pay for, a base service, a gold service, platinum service. You get Google here, you get Flickr there. Is that where we may be headed, Brian?
Well, that's potentially one direction, absolutely, Tom. You know, what we could be looking at here is looking at services that charge you more or for usage of different applications over the internet. So, for example, Verizon could charge you, you know, a fee for you know, watching Netflix over the internet, a different fee than it would charge you for using, say, email. And you know what that could also mean is you could chop that up and slice it up in different ways. So, for instance, as you mentioned, you know, Verizon could start selling you a package of services, and those packages could be priced at different rates, and you know, consumers would have to pay what the services is providing.
In the process of making their arguments before the court that led to this decision, I think it was Verizon who suggested they may be planning exactly that.
Absolutely. In the court oral arguments, Verizon's lawyers said that they, you know, if it weren't for the net neutrality rules, they would absolutely be looking into these alternative business models.
I mean, I'm a Verizon customer, but I sort of like getting on the internet and knowing that I can go and find and access anything that's out there. That free range feeling has been sort of elemental to the allure of the internet for many years. Could that character change, and over what period of time?
It's been, you know, a central part of the internet that you should be able to access, you know, whatever content you see fit, and have that traffic be treated equally, no matter where you are or you know, what plan you're on. But now that could be totally different. You know, you might have a situation where you know, you're trying to watch Netflix, and that might be Netflix may have signed a preferential deal with one service provider, and you know, on the other hand, if you're trying to watch Hulu, Hulu may not have signed any similar deal, and so that company gets you know, thrown to the wayside.
Or for that matter, as I read this decision, they could actually block internet content that doesn't somehow fit into their package.
That's certainly true, although it's not clear to me that it would be in companies' interests to do that necessarily. You know, judging by the outcry that's already taken place as a result of the net neutrality decision from public advocates, you know, I think that companies that serve internet would face a very hard time trying to block services outright. What you might see, you know, is instead is much more, I don't want to say sneaky, but you know, much more subtle ways of routing internet traffic from place to place.
Interests, big and small, have been fighting about this policy for years. The big carriers would like it to be more like a cable television sort of pay-to-play package. The ruling came down last Tuesday in Washington. On Thursday, at a summit on broadband and social justice down there, FCC Commission Chair Tom Wheeler responded to that District of Columbia Circuit Court of Appeals overturning of net neutrality. Wheeler said, and I'll ask you about this, Brian, but he said he's committed to fight back. Here's why.
The great revolution in the internet is how it empowers individuals to both consume and create. It's the kind of opportunity that we're discussing here this morning. And to do so requires an accessible and open internet, and we will fight to preserve that capability.
There, Chair Tom Wheeler of the FCC. But the FCC lost last week. Do they have a way to turn this around, Brian, or is the future of the internet now carved in stone?
Well, there are a couple of ways they could approach this at this point. The simplest way that a lot of people have been pointing out has been for the FCC to simply classify internet providers as similar to the utilities that the FCC regulates, which is includes phone companies and wireless companies and so on. Doing that would allow the FCC to get around the court ruling in a totally legal manner, but that would be politically fraught, and so not a whole lot of people see a lot of promise in that approach.
Politically fraught because these big carriers who don't want net neutrality are also politically muscle-bound here. AT&T shelled out $12 million, in 2013? Verizon ponied up $10 million to politicians in 2013? They're tough to tangle with.
Absolutely. And that's just one of the options that the FCC has at the moment. Another option would be to simply ask the district court to rehear, the D.C. Circuit Court mm-hmm. to rehear the case, a process that would involve a vote by all the judges on the court. And given that President Obama has been trying to put more members of the court onto the, more judges onto the court, presumably Obama's nominees would be friendly to the Democratic agenda of his current FCC. So if you sort of imagine this as a party line kind of thing, you might see more judges voting in favor for rehearing, and then that in turn would increase the chances that the FCC would get a favorable outcome.
So this is
kind of like a do-over for the FCC.
A do-over, maybe. Has this been a party line kind of issue, one party for net neutrality and one against it?
Well, that's one of the things that's been very complicated. In some sense, it does sort of follow along party lines in the sense that if you imagine Republicans to be sort of representative of business and industry players have very much been supported by Republicans in the past, then you could sort of see this as a partisan issue. But on the other hand, matters of the internet and internet policy are often transcendent of partisan politics. You have civil libertarians on the one hand who both come from the realm of libertarian politics as well as conservative and democratic politics as well.
Brian, this is pretty huge given how much of life has migrated to the web. Over what period do you think this will be settled? It could be settled right now, done and over. There'll be challenges, but when will we know if it's going to be a net neutral world or this fenced and tiered world?
That's a great question, and at this point, it's very hard to say. The FCC chairman, Tom Wheeler, has said that he intends to take action on this. He's suggested, although hasn't said outright, that he intends to appeal the decision. Whether that happens could take place over the next sort of several months.
Verizon and more fought for this. Who's fought against it? And presumably, along with that, who would be, if Verizon thinks it's going to be a winner here, who would the losers be, Ryan?
Well, to your first question, Verizon has been the most vocal, most outspoken business fighting against net neutrality rules. The general argument has been that net neutrality rules aren't strictly necessary, that a lot of businesses have done a lot to make sure that the internet stays open to begin with, and so this is kind of solution looking for a problem. But to your second question, you know, I think there's consumers potentially lose out quite a bit on this ruling. But again, you know,
because it becomes more expensive and less open, less free.
Potentially, but you know, as we were just talking about, this, you know, this battle isn't over yet. There's still going to be quite a lot that the FCC can do and probably will do in the coming months. So I wouldn't say that this is all over.
What about the suggestion that innovators would be losers without net neutrality?
Sure. There's an argument that at the margins, you know, giving companies the ability to charge other companies for different services for access to subscribers would harm innovation and would prevent startups from growing and help keep incumbents on top. And the argument there is basically, you know, if I'm Netflix and I'm trying to reach a consumer, say Verizon's consumer, and Verizon is charging me, Netflix, for the right to access that Verizon subscriber, that's an extra charge that Netflix can pay that a smaller startup may not be able to pay.
Sort of like shelf space in a supermarket. If you can pay, you can play. This could change the internet world in a really dramatic way. Brian Fung at the Washington Post, thanks for beginning to take us in here. Grateful to have you with us today.
Thanks for having me.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about what the internet is going to be. Free range or more like cable television after a big court ruling against net neutrality. We heard from Brian Fung there at the Washington Post. Joining us now, voices from either side of this debate. John Bergmeier is with us, senior staff attorney for Public Knowledge. It's a not-for-profit public interest group, argues for a more open internet, wrote an amicus brief in support of the FCC and net neutrality in the most recent court decision. John Bergmeier, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
And from Washington, Randolph May joins us, president of the Free State Foundation, which supports limited government, fewer regulations, does not support net neutrality. The Free State Foundation supporters include telecom companies, foundations, and individuals. Randolph May, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
Let's hear the argument from each of you. Randolph, first to you. What is the argument for doing away with net neutrality as the court has ruled last week?
Well, first I want to say, I just want to push back quickly against something that Brian said that I think is important when he was talking about next steps. And he referred to a potential further court appeal on the D.C. Circuit and mentioned the change in the composition of the court that may occur and new judges coming on. But we ought to recognize that two of the judges that voted to throw out the FCC's rules were appointed by Democratic presidents, and I hate to see the court cast in a way that makes it seems like the judges rule on a partisan basis.
Would not be the first time for general inclinations, but point taken. But what's your big argument? I'm sure people are listening very carefully right now to hear the heart of your argument that we should not have net neutrality.
Right. Here's the heart of the argument. The broadband market that we're talking about, you mentioned Comcast, Verizon, mm-hmm. other companies, it's generally a competitive market, Tom. It's not the classical wheat market we study in Economics 101, but it's generally competitive. And consumers do have alternatives if they're satisfied with their internet service provider. And that's an important place to begin, because what that means is that if the providers are taking actions that consumers don't like, they do have another place to go.
Back up
it's
from
not,
there. If
it's
you would,
not.
Yeah, if you, but back up from there, if you would, because I get it. If I've got alternatives for a carrier in my area and I don't like mm-hmm. what one is doing, I could go to another. But that's complicated and difficult and a hassle, and some places do have monopolies when it comes to this. Let's back up from there. What's the argument for not? A lot of people like the internet as it's been with this net neutrality policy and lots of access to everybody for all kinds of providers. What's the argument for the change, Randolph?
Well, competition does make a difference, but let's just assume that we might disagree on how much competition
No, I grant that's out there, but why do it in the first place? Why make the change?
The reason to make the change is because the internet continues to evolve. Consumers' preferences continue to evolve. You're, I think, assuming that consumers' preferences are all the same. But let me give you an example, concrete example of why differentiation is good, because that's what we're really talking about here, is whether internet providers can, because we have a competitive marketplace, can compete by differentiating themselves from other competitors.
So the way it's packaged through one provider would be different from another. Okay.
Let me give you a current example, and I think this is useful to help understand it. AT&T just a couple of weeks ago, in fact, less than 2 weeks ago, announced a new plan, which it calls a sponsored data offering. This is in the wireless area. But the opponents of net neutrality immediately came out against this plan. What that sponsored data plan does, Tom, as you may know, it allows edge providers, the content providers, to agree with AT&T, say, for example, ESPN, Google, whatever, that they're going to support the usage of AT&T's wireless subscribers so that while they're on the ESPN site or whatever, that those usage charges that otherwise would accrue won't apply, and that the content provider will pay AT&T.
So I'm going to download Big, and they'll subsidize that in a way and make
They'll subsidize it. Now, here's the point.
Okay.
Immediately, the net neutrality opponents came out against that, said that would violate net neutrality principles. It's not technically a net neutrality violation because the rules didn't apply in the same way to wireless providers. But nevertheless, they immediately made that argument. Now, if you're a consumer and thinking about it from a consumer's point of view, what you have here is essentially a 1-800 toll-free type of service for your wireless plan.
And for some piece of it, for some part of the content world,
Well, if you like to visit ESPN and watch basketball games, or you want to use your iPad to watch movies on Netflix, you might think that it's a good thing for you as a consumer if you're not going to incur overage charges while you're doing that. And that's what AT&T's plan does.
So that's with sponsored data. I think we've got a beginning on it there. So you could tailor, you could, different consumers may have different appetites. And you're saying with this, the companies could respond to those. They've already begun with sponsored data there. Randolph, I'll come back to you. John Bergmeier, what's the heart of the argument against dropping net neutrality? The argument for saving it at this point, because it looks like it's on its way out.
Sure. I mean, people spend a lot of time trying to figure out what net neutrality is, but it's really not that complicated. It's the principle that the company that connects you to the internet does not get to control what you do on the internet. And this is nothing new. In fact, this is how the phone network has worked for more than 100 years. If you place a call to Vinny's Pizza, you're not going to get connected over to Papa John's instead. And your voice isn't going to drop out if you call the provider that that hasn't paid extra for that extra quality of service. Overall, the internet has thrived because it's open. We don't want a few big ISPs to change that simply because they, you know, contrary to Randy's point, they don't really face the competition that's necessary to keep them in line. In fact, the FCC, in the order, which obviously was just struck down, it found when it adopted the order that for internet service with advertised download speeds of 10 megabits download speed, nearly 60% of households lived in a place that are only served by one wireline provider, with nearly 80% who live in an area that is served by only two.
So,
I don't think only one or two providers is enough so-called competition to keep people in line.
So, John, look, cast your mind forward. If net neutrality goes down, I mean, it's down right now. If it doesn't get back up, we go down this road, what material changes? Describe the world of the internet that's likely to emerge in this new regime.
Yeah, sure. I mean, this is assuming that the FCC doesn't reenact the rules.
For the moment, assume that and paint it for us.
Sure. I think it benefits the large ISPs like Comcast, Verizon, Time Warner Cable. I think it might actually benefit the very large web companies who I'm really not that interested in protecting.
Like,
we always talk about Google and Netflix because, you know, they're important examples. But what I'm more concerned about is the startups, the companies that, you know, maybe these large companies, they can adapt to the new world. They have the financing that they're able to cut the deals they need to keep surviving. They might not like it, but they can do it. I'm worried about the startups who can't afford to pay these extra costs to make sure they reach consumers. If their services are lower quality compared with the big guys, you know, you might just stick with the big guys. And I think that would be a fundamental change to the way the internet has worked so far, where anyone can just sort of connect up to the internet and start an interesting new service and people go to use it. Now, I don't think that the big ISPs are going to pull a lever and all of a sudden, you know, the internet as we know it goes away. I think it'll just be, you know, very slow changes could happen. You know, it's an overused anecdote, but, you know, the boiling frog, you know, the small changes add up over time. And then, you know, lo and behold, it's many years later and we have to tell our grandchildren about how the internet used to be.
I'm not sure it would be many years later. I mean, Verizon's talking about these changes already. And as Randolph points out, sponsored data is already a fact out there. John Bergmeier, Randolph May, please stand by. Lots of callers for both of you. Let's go to some here. Shay in Salem, Massachusetts. Shay, you're on the air. Thank you for calling. What do you think?
Tom, thanks for taking my call. Mm-hmm. Long-time listener, first-time caller.
Great.
So I think that a couple of things. First, I am one of the 60% where I live in Salem, Mass., a very populous area. I'm only served by Comcast, mm-hmm. so I don't have any options.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's abhorrent, Tom, continued monopolization. I'm wondering, you know, it seems like we're just a stone throw away from the kind of censorship of places like China and so on. I'm wondering if there's anything that we, the consumers, we the people who have to pay for these exorbitant services where Comcast gets to raise our rates whenever they want, what recourse do we have? Do we have to rely on the FCC or these big guys to decide to play ball on behalf of, you know, everyday people?
Yeah.
Or is there something that we can do?
Well, I'll ask, but Shay, I mean, I get the concern on rates. If you know cable TV, you know how that can be. But what, comparing this to censorship in China, where it's the government that brings down, you know, the heavy hand here, this would not be government. There would be plenty of elements of competition, even if you don't have it, and many don't, as John points out. But China-style censorship, do you really mean that?
I do. I mean, and just like your second guest, mm-hmm. Who just spoke said, you know, if I call for a pizza, I want to call Papa John's, but Comcast decides that they would rather me go with Domino's. You know, what kind of, this opens a Pandora's box. It really opens a door that no one really knows any of the answers. And to be honest with you, Tom, it's frightening as all get out, because where does it end? Where does it lead to? And then what are we, the you know, everyday person who goes to work for a paycheck,
yep.
where are we left? It feels like we're just being left in the mire by these big guys who want to continue to monopolize and, you know, make money and make money and make money and put the profit over the individual life experience. It's my concern.
Shay, I appreciate your call. The internet certainly had that feeling of a different kind of realm where it wasn't financial muscle that privileged who you were going to find or what you had access to. John Bergmeier, explain for us exactly. I mean, Shay's worried about, you know, censorship a la China. There is the capacity to block that is part of this. What is that that's sanctioned under this ruling, John?
Well, there's no rules right now in place that would prevent an ISP from blocking access to any site or degrading access to any service. So the question is, maybe they don't want to block access to something that is that people might expect, but you know, there could be pressure now that you're able to block. Once you're able to do
well, that's
something,
what I mean. Able. What makes you able under this latest ruling?
Because there's no legal recourse if they do. It doesn't violate the rules because the rules are no longer in place.
I see. Okay.
So let's say that there's a site where, you know, some people are saying it's allowing terrorists to talk and other people are saying, oh, no, this is a valid political movement. What if there's pressure for them to block it? Now, I don't want to go down, you know, the censorship can be a little bit of a distraction from this issue. But I think that concentrations of power, whether they're private or government, can lead to trouble. Certainly ISPs are not the only thing we have to worry about. We have to worry about the NSA. Large web companies have a lot of power, too. But I think any time where people, see themselves as having no choice but to do business with a company, that company ends up having a lot of power.
Randolph may speak to Shay's concern there. She only has one carrier. And she's concerned that you may not call it censorship, but that she'll be blocked from some internet content or steered toward other internet content in a way that it's hard for her as a consumer to get around. What's her answer? What's your answer to that?
Well, I don't know exactly Shay's situation where she lives, but let me make this point because it's a common mistaken assumption. When she talks about having one carrier, she probably does have wireless service. I understand they're not comparable in all respects.
No, they're not.
But Tom, a lot of people, as you know, use their iPads now to do a lot of things that they do used to do with their wireline. She may have DSL there, but let's assume for a moment that she doesn't have wireless, doesn't have DSL.
Or that
DSL
those hoops
available.
Are a little high for
that she couldn't watch Netflix the same way.
Yep.
With her iPhone. But, of course, not everyone likes to do that, Tom. But here's the point, I think John would agree with this, the prospect of these internet providers blocking access to sites so that you can't get to Papa John's versus Domino's is really, really remote. There hasn't been a history of that at all. And there's a reason why that's the case. They're in business – of course, to satisfy consumers, to get more users of their networks. And if they were to take an action like that, the consumers would rise up en masse, and you would find that, in fact, it's not – for a lot of people, they could make a switch. It's not the same in every single area, but we haven't seen any history of that before – the adoption of the net neutrality rule. All of the providers have said they don't intend to block. So I think to talk about it in that way is really, really an exaggeration.
Well, I wonder about that. And it goes to Shay's question. You say consumers will rise up en masse, but you look at cable television where there are lots of complaints over time and consumers kind of just get buckled into it. John, Shay asks, what can consumers do if they don't like this new texture of the internet that appears to be in the offing here without a change? What can they do? Is it just change internet service provider? Is there something more than that, John?
Well, if they're lucky enough to change internet service provider, if they actually do live in one of the relatively few places that have that option, then sure, you know, why not do that? But I think most people don't really face that as a realistic choice. So I think what you have to do is contact the FCC. You have to contact your congressman. Ultimately, this has to be a political process. You know, maybe your local municipality can build a competing broadband network, to compete with the local cable or telephone monopoly, if that's an option. You know, and we could always hope for some new technology to save us down the road. Maybe wireless technology will one day be good enough to really compete head-on in all respects with what you have on the wireline side. I don't want to pin my hopes in that. And in the meantime, you know, if the ISPs say that they don't want to block access to sites, then what's the harm in having a rule which tells them that they can't do the very thing they say they don't want to do to begin with?
Tom, can I make one quick
sure.
point, please?
Mm-hmm.
And I think a lot of the ISPs would not object to a no blocking rule. I think John would agree that the principal objection they had was to the no discrimination rule. And
we can the talk blocking about that rule is no blocking
more,
is gone.
Well, I understand. That's what the court said. The FCC didn't have authority to adopt it. But let me make this point because the court also
just 20 seconds before
said
the break,
this,
Randall.
That the FCC still retains authority over broadband providers. They just threw out this rule. There are other types of measures, more focused measures, that the FCC could use to get at any real anti-competitive problems.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about what the internet is going to be, free range or more like cable television, after a big court ruling against net neutrality. John Bergmeier is with us from Public Knowledge in Washington. Randolph May from the Free State Foundation. For a long time, Google was fighting hard for net neutrality, said that you need that open frontier for the next Google to emerge. Here's a 2006 public service announcement from Google.
Why should I be able to surf wherever I want?
Who needs a gazillion sites?
Can someone please just block my favorite sites?
I don't care what music I listen to.
I want someone to choose for me.
I want someone to choose it for me.
Let's leave the internet with the big corporations where it belongs.
Google there making the case against dropping net neutrality. For right now, it's gone. Barry Diller, CEO of IAC, whose websites include About.com, Ask.com, Match.com, a couple years ago spoke to Fortune magazine about how net neutrality, he said, helps for innovation, entrepreneurs.
The ability of these people out of nothing to create these incredible businesses. Jeff Bezos driving across the country to establish Amazon.com. You know, he didn't have to ask anybody. He just put it up on the internet and people started to use it. There was nobody between him and the audience.
As of last week, net neutrality gone. The argument's gone on for a long time. 2009, John Stewart came to the defense of those pushing for net neutrality. He played clips of Republican representatives Phil Gingrey of Georgia, Lamar Smith of Texas, and Joe Wilson, South Carolina.
Who could possibly be against establishing net neutrality?
Net neutrality would destroy this model of service that consumers have come to expect and it already works and works well.
Could that lead to the government trying to regulate or take over the internet?
We need to ensure we do not disrupt the necessary flexibility that has led to a vibrant marketplace, one which continues to foster new technology around the world, helping liberate people of Afghanistan, Iraq, and Iran.
Wait, what the? We could have liberated them over the internet?
John Stewart having fun, but you can hear the politicians there lining up against net neutrality. Craig in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. Craig, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. I knew sooner or later they'd mess up the internet. It's never enough money for these people. They haven't been able to tailor, anything else. So how can they tailor the internet? What we need, if this goes through, is a global movement where people will drop their accounts from any of these entities that have caused this decision.
It's going to be pretty cold and lonely if you do that, Craig. I mean, people want internet access.
Yeah, but it always gets passed to the consumers. And we can't afford it anymore.
Craig, I appreciate your call. We'll pick it up. Let me get one more right here. Krista in Maynard, Massachusetts. Krista, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I was wondering how the end of net neutrality would affect nonprofit websites. And I'm thinking about the National Archives or the Smithsonian or places that stream audio or video, such as NPR's own website.
Or libraries, or you name it, small nonprofit players. Let us look at that. John Bergmeier, what about it?
Sure. I think some of the smaller players, nonprofits or libraries, archives, they're not going to be in the position to be able to afford to, for example, to pay AT&T for sponsored data. So when it comes down to it, if a consumer is faced with a choice, one website costs him money and the other doesn't, he's going to go with the one that doesn't. Or it could just be that, if you try to stream video from a cool website like the Internet Archive at archive.org, it just buffers because they haven't paid up. And those are exactly the sites that are in the worst position to be able to cope with a payola internet.
So that diversity and depth of information we've come to expect on the internet, you're saying would be disadvantaged under this system?
Yeah, I mean, when you think about the internet, people often look immediately to the big companies because they make headlines and the business press talks about them. But the internet gives everyone an opportunity to communicate, not just companies, everyday people, nonprofits, small community organizations, and even individuals. You know, it can be hard to afford a computer and to get internet access for sure. But, once you are able to connect to the internet, it's much easier to make your voice heard than through print TV or, I'm sorry to say, radio. And I don't want that to go away in the future.
But it's going away right now. Steve in Wethersfield, Connecticut. Steve, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I have a small business, and I have a website, and I've been able to reach customers all over the country, all over the world, and it hasn't cost much at all to keep this going. I operate the site myself and make updates, and I'm wondering, how this is going to affect me. Will I still be able to, reach customers? Am I going to have to pay a lot more for that access?
Yeah, let us pick it up. Randolph May, what about a small businessman with a website what the future holds for him without net neutrality here?
Yeah, I don't expect any change, Tom. I think, again, there's a lot of speculation that I don't think is going to be borne out about
Let me explain why the telcos had the yellow pages for many years as a great big profit center. Wouldn't it be very inviting for them to offer Steve better access if he was paying a la yellow pages style?
Here's the way that I think Steve might be affected, possibly, if net neutrality is reimposed on kind of strictest terms. Since 2000, no one disputes that the telephone companies, cable companies, and so forth have invested over $500 million to build out these broadband networks. Ultimately, unless you want the government to run the networks, and I understand there's some people that prefer that, but let's assume that that's not going to happen. Tom, ultimately, that $500 million investment has to be recovered by someone, and ultimately it's going to be recovered by the users of the network.
Aren't they making a return on their investment right now?
They're making some return, but of course the question, of course, is always, are they making sufficient return time to keep investing or not? Now, let me put this point on it. Netflix and YouTube today are responsible every evening for approximately 50% of the internet traffic in this country. A lot of people don't know that.
Yeah. Wow, that's a lot.
Not sure you were aware of that. 50% of the traffic on average every evening. Now, if you can devise a way that without degrading the connections of other sites, but you can get Netflix and YouTube, Google, to subsidize or pay for some of that traffic, users going to their site, so that they're paying for some, don't you believe that that will help prevent the broadband providers from having to raise the consumers' rates, end users' rates, like Steve, so that his bill will go up? Remember, ultimately, Tom, these networks have to be paid for. They're going to be paid for. Maybe it's your position that the broadband providers are making too much money.
That would be a
whole other debate. But I think you'll agree that ultimately the networks are going to be paid for, and there may be ways that that can be done that benefit people like Steve, because I don't think that he's responsible for anything approaching.
Well, there's a profit interest here. We get that. There's also a public interest, though, when it comes to the flow of information.
Sure.
It's been acknowledged for a long time. Randolph may stand by. John Bergmeier. I want to bring into our conversation from Princeton, New Jersey, Jennifer Rexford, professor of computer science at Princeton University. She serves on the FCC's Open Internet Advisory Committee. It was set up to evaluate the effect of the open internet net neutrality rules. Jennifer Rexford, thank you very much for being with us today.
Great. Thanks for having me.
Do you think net neutrality is over? It's on the mat right now. Is it going to stay down, done?
So clearly having some scrutiny over blocking and discrimination is hugely valuable, and that clearly took a hit last week. But a couple things are worth noting. Transparency as a requirement is still in place, and the court of public opinion is quite powerful as well, as we've seen already in the backlash to AT&T's announcement of sponsored data plans. So I think there's a limit to how far the carriers will go with this new freedom to block and discriminate because of the risk of commercial backlash and the risk of that backlash causing new legal frameworks to be proposed for them.
So you think net neutrality will go away and then we'll just depend on the big companies, carriers, to self-regulate?
I think to some extent that can happen. And to the extent that doesn't work, there'll be an even stronger impetus for further legal action. So I think we'll be in a somewhat delicate balance for a time to figure out how that plays out.
What's the backlash to sponsored data? What's the rationale for the backlash, Jennifer?
So the rationale is that it basically – well, first of all, it all ultimately comes back to consumers in some form of cost. But the bigger issue is the small players, the players that don't exist yet or that are small or niche in that they won't be able to pay to play. And to put that in really concrete terms, some new competitor to Netflix, some new competitor to Hulu emerges and tries to get venture capital funding. Is a VC going to pay for a company that's going to have to overcome an even larger hurdle now to be able to reach a large number of consumers?
You say there's a backlash, but do you really see that sponsored data path being narrowed or shut down?
I don't think it will necessarily be shut down, but I think it's already a sign that even for a small step that might have already have been acceptable under the Open Internet Order, you're already seeing consumers being negative and the press responding in a negative way.
What about Randolph May's argument from the other side? If every evening half of the traffic on the web is Netflix and YouTube, it can look like kind of a subsidy that may, you know, make other things slower. Does that make sense? Is it, or, I mean, you could say it doesn't, or you could say it's worth it to keep an open frontier, net neutrality overall. How do you look at it, Jennifer?
So I agree that the carriers have to make money, and it's not just because they're a business and want to make money.
But they are making money, aren't they?
And they do need to be able to reinvest that in infrastructure. I think the key question here is the things they do, should they be application agnostic or not? And there are application agnostic ways to do
– What do you mean by application agnostic?
So what I mean by that is usage caps, usage-based charging, or even newer ideas like congestion-based pricing where users pay more during peak periods of load. All of those schemes can be done without saying that Netflix gets penalized in a particular way as opposed to some other content. And so there is a whole realm of schemes that carriers could use to make sure that they get paid back for the investment that they're putting in their infrastructure without targeting individual applications.
But isn't it all leaning into pay-to-play that would advantage those who can pay more and disadvantage those who don't?
Yeah, and I think carriers are going that way for first of all because they can and they know that these content providers have big pockets, and also because some of these billing models I just mentioned are complicated and unattractive to consumers. And so I think these sponsored data plans are somewhat middle ground where consumers might be comfortable with them because they don't have to think ahead of time about exactly how many minutes of Netflix they're watching. And yet there's still a way for the carriers to get compensated for their bandwidth usage.
And yet
the big risk, though, is the way it hurts the new entrants.
And if we wake up some years from now and find the internet just doesn't offer what it did. Scott in Omaha, Nebraska. Scott, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi, Tom. Thanks
sure.
for taking my call.
Yeah.
I caught a show about a year ago down – it was on NPR down in Kansas City.
Mm-hmm.
And Google is presently putting fiber optic cable down there, I think last mile off the main line.
Okay.
And they had a guest on there that pointed out some facts, on just how the big money is basically putting a squeeze on everybody. You know, like the four or five big cable companies, when it was rolled out in the late 70s, early 80s, they basically split the country up. And said, this is our territory. You play in your yard, we'll play on ours. And they've just jacked rates up. You can go out of the country. I think the guest pointed out, Seoul, Korea, you've got, 10 possible providers of service. They get better downloads at about a third of the cost.
So what do you take from that, Scott? Are you anticipating a higher cost for Internet usage, less access, or better service?
Well, I don't think we'll get any of the above unless the rules get changed to squelch the big money in this. One of your guests was saying, "Well, we've been spending all this money to improve service. Well, where does that money come from? It's coming from the customer. So essentially, it's our money. They're skimming it and reinvesting some of it."
Yeah, and a lot to think about there on what we're going to have down the road. Scott, I appreciate your call. One more. Eric in Hartford, Vermont. Eric, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I live in one of those areas that where at the speeds I need for work, I work from home. Yeah. I only have one provider I can choose from. But what I want to know is why can't we have it both ways? When the current internet wasn't suitable for research scientists, they created Internet 2. Why can't we have it both ways and mandate that there be a neutral net provided to all? But if a consumer thinks that a top-down service, if they like, say, Verizon's top-down service and their features, they can subscribe to their top-down internet rather than their neutral internet.
If they want it packaged up a la cable TV style. John Bergmeier, how about it? Could we have it both ways?
Well, I mean, nothing is stopping a company like Verizon from offering its own online services that compete with everybody else. So I'm not exactly sure what this new service is supposed to do. Verizon just announced that it bought some video streaming technology from Intel, and it might very well launch a nationwide video service that competes head-on with Netflix. I think that would be interesting.
Could it end up then blocking Netflix, hypothetically, over Verizon, and you'd only have access to Verizon's video?
That's one possibility. I think a sort of more interesting possibility is, what if Verizon does want to launch a nationwide service and it needs to access other people's networks, like it needs to access Comcast customers too? You know, maybe Verizon or a company like Verizon that's also an ISP that wants to get into other lines of business might start wishing for a neutral internet where it could, be sure to reach customers nationwide.
Jennifer, for consumers, citizens who just think public interest-wise, we want net neutrality, what is their most effective way of responding to these changes that are underway right now and could have really big implications long term?
I think public response is clearly important, and I think having groups like our Open Internet Advisory Committee that the FCC to still provide some level of scrutiny, even if there's not a legal framework for it, so that there's a reasoned and discussion and response to whatever actions carriers might take in the coming weeks and months.
What do you think of the chances, you're closer to the FCC than most of us, that they'll be able to effectively turn around what happened last week?
I think it's tricky because I think most of the avenues, as was discussed earlier in the program, are at a minimum time-consuming and some of them quite politically fraught. So I think unless there's a major public outcry, it's going to be difficult to make major change.
People say politically fraught. That sounds like a euphemism. Does that mean the big carriers invest enough money in Washington that it's hard to go up against what they want?
Yeah, I think that's a good way of putting it.
That's pretty simple. That's pretty basic. That requires some head-scratching to get around. Maybe people will want to. Maybe, as Randolph May says, they will not. But it's all on the table, and I hope it's clear now at the end of an hour of looking at net neutrality. I want to thank all three of my guests today. Jennifer Rexford at Princeton University, thank you very much for joining us today, Jennifer.
My pleasure.
Randolph May at the Free State Foundation, thank you for joining us, Randolph.
Thank you, Tom.
And John Bergmeier at Public Knowledge in Washington, thanks for being with us, John.
Thank you very much.
In this hour tomorrow, fighting for life without parole for young offenders, I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.